Case number 20-3485, Lynn Donovan v. First Credit Incorporated. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Jeffrey Parker for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, and may it please the court, this case requires the court to answer two questions. Does Section 1692F8 of the FDCPA, which facially bans nearly all markings on debt collection envelopes, include an implied exception for benign language? And if so, is the language at issue in this case benign? Upholding the decision under review requires answering yes to both questions, while law and logic compel a resounding no to each. As with any case turning on contested questions of statutory interpretation, it behooves us to begin with the statutory text. That relevant text prohibits any debt collector from, quote, using any language or symbol other than the debt collector's address on any envelope when communicating with a consumer by use of the mails or by telegram, except that a debt collector may use his business name if such name does not indicate that he is in the debt collection business. The parties agree that Congress structured the plain text of 1692F8 as a blanket ban on nearly all markings on debt collection envelopes. Nevertheless, First Credit asserts that Section 1692F8 must be read together with its legislative history to include an unwritten exception for any and all benign language that does not reveal that an envelope pertains to debt collection. In order to get to a search of the statute's legislative history, First Credit must present, to quote Judge Sutton's opinion in OfficeMax, Inc. v. United States, the necessary warrant for such a search, meaning that it must show that the statute's plain language is either ambiguous or it creates absurd results. As the OfficeMax opinion goes on to point out, a statute is only ambiguous if its meaning remains unclear after applying the traditional canons of statutory construction. And one of those canons is that an absurd interpretation is to be avoided if an alternative, reasonable interpretation is available. Here, the courts and the parties have offered only two possible plain language readings of the statute. Under appellant's reading, favored by the Seventh Circuit in Preston and the Fifth Circuit in Peter, the plain text of the statute permits a debt collector to communicate with a consumer by use of the mails so long as it does not use any language or symbol other than the debt collector's address, sometimes its name, and the markings that are part of the common sense meaning of the phrase communicating with a consumer by use of the mails, including a consumer's name, address, and postage. Under First Credit's reading, favored by the courts that have adopted the benign language exception, common sense is left at the door, and the plain text of the statute is held to prohibit a debt collector from using markings that are necessary to permit an envelope to reach a consumer through the mails, a result that everyone, First Credit and all of the courts, agree is absurd. Appellant agrees that both readings are, in a literal sense, possible, but appellant points out that because the first reading creates an absurd result and this first reading does not create an absurd result and the second does, the choice between them is clear and the inquiry is at an end. First Credit, by contrast, is in an unenviable position. It must argue that its admittedly absurd plain text reading is the only one available, for if there is an alternative, non-absurd plain text reading, resort to legislative history is impermissible. Unfortunately, First Credit's brief does not actually argue that appellant's preferred interpretation is either unavailable or even unreasonable. Rather, First Credit attempts a gotcha, saying that because appellant admits that it is technically possible to read the statute two ways, appellant has admitted the statute is ambiguous. But as the Third Circuit put it in Newcastle County v. Hartford Accident and Indemnity Co., ambiguity does not mean that a statute is open to more than one meaning in a metaphysical sense. A clever lawyer can always find some sort of ambiguity in any text. A statute is ambiguous for the purposes of statutory interpretation, however, only where it is open to more than one reasonable interpretation. And as for
Mr. Parker, it seems you're reading your argument. Am I wrong about that?
To a large extent, yes, Your Honor. If you'd like, I have bullet points as well.
I mean, really, we have some questions, and number one, my question would be, do you think that the court needs to resort to anything beyond the plain text in order to find for you?
No, Your Honor.
You agree, that is your position is the plain text has you winning.
That's correct. The plain text plus common sense, Your Honor.
Right. Okay. That's what I wanted. We don't need to resort to, in your view is we needn't resort to the benign aspect and read that into it. Okay, got it.
That is correct, Your Honor. The benign language aspect is only available if we resort to the legislative history, and it is appellant's position that we don't need to resort to legislative history because adding common sense to the plaintiff's
position. What is the name of your client?
Lynn Donovan, Your Honor.
Thank you. Let's start using that. Okay. I know you were in the role of appellant, but your argument, A, you shouldn't be reading it, and B, let's use our client's name. That it would just be a better argument. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So on the legislative history point, which way does the legislative history cut?
Your Honor, there's only about one half of one sentence of legislative history that's at issue in this case. The only legislative history that any court has cited or that First Credit cites is the sentence in the section by section summary of the Senate report when they referred it out of committee. That one half of one sentence reads, if you'll give me one moment, that one half of one sentence reads that that a debt collector is barred from, quote, using symbols on envelopes indicating that contents pertain to debt collection. So that sentence, for instance, doesn't mention language. It only mentions symbols. It's just from a summary. The summary doesn't purport to be comprehensive. The summary actually, it's from a single paragraph that contains two sentences that describes the entirety of Section F of the FDCPA. Section F has 8 subsections. The summary in the Senate report does not mention 3 of them. That's subsections 2 through 4. Summary, as I said, doesn't mention language, but only symbols. It makes very little sense to take the entire purpose of subsection F8 from a half sentence summary that doesn't purport to be comprehensive. And there's no other legislative history on which to rely.
So I know your opponent is going to argue that we should apply a benign language or exception. What's wrong with that idea? If assuming that there is ambiguity.
I apologize, Your Honor. Could you?
Yeah. What's wrong with the benign language exception, assuming that there is ambiguity?
Your Honor, assuming that there is ambiguity, there are a couple of problems with the benign language exception. First, the best evidence of congressional intent is the text of the statute itself. And the text of the statute structures the ban as a blanket ban with a very narrow set of exceptions for the debt collector's name and address, things that are related to getting it back through the mail, which means that obviously they assumed that it was possible to send it through the mail in the first place. The ban is a blanket ban with a very narrow exception. The benign language exception instead allows any symbols or language on a debt collection envelope, except for those that reveal that the envelope pertains to debt collection, which means that it flips it on its head to a blanket permission with a very narrow ban. In addition, the benign language exception.
And Counselor, what does that do to the congressional intent to have a bright line rule?
Your Honor, what that does is it completely kills the bright line rule. The benign language exception has proven nearly impossible for courts to apply. Because after all, a bright line rule that Congress enacted has several benefits. The bright line rule has the benefit that it makes compliance easy for debt collectors because they know what the rule is and they don't have to worry about whether or not saying time-sensitive document on a letter does or does not violate, which it does in many jurisdictions, and it doesn't in many jurisdictions. It's been found there. For instance, in Preston, the Seventh Circuit has said. In Strand, the Eighth Circuit said that the benign language exception allows language like urgent mail, things like that. But in Douglas v. Conversion Outsourcing, the Third Circuit said that even if the benign language exception existed, it would not be benign to put a barcode that might contain an account number on a letter. The benign language exception has proven basically impossible for anyone to decide what is and what isn't benign. Even between Strand and Goswami, which Goswami is the Fifth Circuit decision that is the other main decision favoring the benign language exception, their formulations of the standard are totally different. So the benign language exception is very difficult to apply. It creates a whole lot of litigation. A Lexis search for the benign language exception pops up over 60 cases. Those probably represent an order of magnitude more cases that were actually filed and even more claims that were argued about. If we adopt the bright line rule that Congress intended to adopt, it reduces the amount of litigation overall, which Preston, the Seventh Circuit decision indicates, is the entire point of adopting such a bright line rule. Also, moving on to the question of benign whether or not the language issue in this case is benign, this court held in this year in Cagayan United Collection Bureau Incorporated that under the FDCPA, a business may not use, the exact quote is, under the FDCPA, a business cannot display on an envelope that a specific person owes a debt. In this case, both parties agree that First Credit did exactly that. When it put on the in the envelope a return mailer that showed through the glassine window, the phrase is payment in full is enclosed and I need to discuss this further. My phone number is, shows that she owed a debt. Thank you, Your Honor, for those reasons. We request that the district court decision be reversed and remanded.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Benjamin Shaver, Serdik Dowd and Turner on behalf of Appalee First Credit. I disagree strenuously with some of the things that opposing counsel has said, not surprising, I'm sure, to the panel. First, I don't think that the benign language exception has proven impossible to apply. I think it's been applied relatively easily by courts, like the district court below in this case.
Doesn't it leave it open, though, the benign language exception, leave it open to disparate interpretations by different courts?
Well, I don't think that we need to leave it open to different interpretations. I do believe that the legislative history and the FTC's interpretation of this particular section is instructive. The Senate at the time of the passage of the FDCPA in 1977 had indicated that this particular subsection, F8, which counsel accurately described as a comprehensive ban on just about anything except the debt collector's name, if it doesn't suggest that he's in the debt collection business, and also its address, that comprehensive ban was only intended by Congress to cover language that might suggest the contents of the envelope inside, which makes perfect sense from a policy.
When you're talking about the Senate language, is it in fact the one sentence that your opponent mentions, or do you have other legislative history?
That's the only known legislative history, I believe, Your Honor, on behalf or with respect to this particular section. There's certainly no legislative history that talks about it in another context or in another way. This is the only instruction from the Senate's mind at the time of passage of the statute.
And there's no other legislative history, right, that you've been uncovered?
Not from the House of Representatives or the Senate that First Credit is aware of, Your Honor. But certainly the FTC has interpreted this in 1988, which I note that this court, the Sixth Circuit, as counsel mentioned, there was a case before it with respect to F8 earlier this year. I may have butchered the name. I thought it was Cagayan.
I'm familiar with that case.
I'm sorry, Judge?
I'm familiar with that case, given that I was on it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't we get to the language of F8 itself?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is the ambiguity in F8?
The ambiguity. Well, I don't know if it's ambiguous, Your Honor. I think it's actually pretty clear, and it's a clear prohibition of anything but the two identified exceptions. Those exceptions being the debt collector's address and the debt collector's name, so long as it does not suggest that he is in the debt collection business.
So why not apply it then?
What's that?
Why not apply that provision exactly as it's written? Why isn't it plain language?
Because if you apply that provision as written, you're going to get an absurd result. No piece of mail is ever going to be able to move through because the debt collector, or excuse me, the consumer's name, for example, is not one of the identified exceptions, nor is the or postage, I think, could not have a pre-stamped postage mark on there. That would also be prohibited under the plain language as it's written in subsection F8.
But F8 allows for communicating with a consumer by use of the mails or by telegram. So isn't the obvious logical meaning that what the U.S. Post Office requires there to be for the U.S. mail to go through would be on it? And that usually is the address of the recipient and the name of the recipient and postage. And then, just to be clear, F8 allows the debt collector's address as a return address, which is a normal postal thing that people do, but they're specific in F8, the debt collector's address. And then under certain circumstances, can use the business name as long as it isn't Debt Collectors Inc. or something like that.
Correct. And I think if Congress had actually, if they had done a better job in drafting, they would have identified those exceptions that Your Honor just spoke about with respect to the consumer's name. They obviously took the time to accept the debt collector's address, the return mail address for it to come back, or the debt collector's name, so long as it doesn't suggest what business he's in.
But wasn't that the point of the statutory provision? That was what Congress was directing its attention to. And so it spoke only to that in the context of talking about mailed information coming to consumers. So I don't understand why it's not obvious from the language itself that you are engaged in mailing. Practical reality of that is you got to have an address and you got to have a postage stamp. Then here is what you as the mailing debt collector may or may not put on the face of that document. Isn't that the only reasonable interpretation of that language?
Well, I do think that it's one interpretation, Your Honor. But I think that it necessarily implies or suggests that there are some implications that are baked into the language. And I think if we're talking about implied language within here, then we're talking about what did Congress intend when it drafted that language, when it passed this language. And I think if we're talking about those baked in implications.
Well, your opposing counsel suggests that it must be, in order to reach ambiguity, you must have two reasonable interpretations. And you're telling us that the interpretation, that it's absurd that you could not have postal markings on it. So you don't have a second reasonable interpretation. So how do you ever get to the question of legislative history?
Well, Your Honor, First Credit believes that the interpretation that the plain language only permits those two identified exceptions as stated in the language is a reasonable interpretation. Obviously, I think that there's some reasonable disagreement about what the statute means. The fact that the Fifth and the Eighth Circuit.
So your position is it's a reasonable interpretation of a statutory provision addressing mailed documents to assume that it is not going to allow an address or a postage stamp.
That's what the language of the statute says. That's what the plain language says. But Your Honor, I would respond also and say that even if Your Honors were to agree with the reasoning of the Seventh Circuit and what in the reasoning or the, excuse me, the interpretation of this particular statutory section that Ms. Donovan urges, there's no need. There is still room for the benign language exception. The FDCPA.
Mr. Shaver, tell us how. You said there's room. I want you to go right to that. What's the answer?
Yes, Your Honor. The FDCPA was enacted in order to protect both consumers and debt collectors. It was enacted to protect ethical debt collectors who don't engage in abusive practices, from liability for unreasonable suits. And I think when this benign language exception first came about, I believe the Central District of California issued a decision in 1991. It's the Masuda versus Thomas Richards case, I believe. They didn't refer to the legislative history of the statute. They just said that prescribing, in that case, I believe it was priority letter or something on the outside of the envelope. They said that prescribing that language did not further the purposes of the FDCPA. With respect to section 1692E, it's the section right before 1692F. It talks about, and it has a bright line ban on, it bars and prohibits a debt collector from making any false, deceptive, or misleading representation in connection with the collection of a debt. And that is a bright line. There's any. It says any, just like an F8, which also says, any language or symbol other than the identified exceptions. However, this court, I know for at least the last 10 years, going back to Miller v. Javich, Block, and Rathbone, adopting, I believe it was a decision from Judge Easterbrook in the Seventh Circuit, we've read a materiality requirement into Section E. That is, any false, deceptive, or misleading representation is only actionable if it's material. The word material is not in the statute, right? That is something that has been, I think, developed by the courts in response and to apply the FDCPA in a reasonable and equitable manner.
Well, I'm struggling a little bit with argument about the equity, because it seems to me that if this is interpreted in the practical methodology, it's better for your client. How much will debt collectors spend on trying to second guess what the courts are going to say about whether this is benign or non-benign language. Your opposing counsel suggested the extent of the litigation of the question. That costs your client money. Wouldn't your client just rather know up front that it cannot do these items? Then it acts on that knowledge. It saves the money of all this litigation. That seems to me to be the infinitely practical way to handle this for both parties. Why is that not the case?
Well, Judge, my client, didn't print information on the outside of the envelope, right? We're talking about information because of the way that the letter was folded or structured within this particular envelope, that it revealed these particular words. I believe it's 15 words and two checkboxes,
indicate declaration. And because you can see it, if they understood that this was a bright line rule, you cannot put anything on the outside or show anything through a window on the outside of the envelope, they'd have looked at the people they purchased from and they'd have said, I want you to print my name on the outside, or I want one glassine spot there, and that's what I'm going to use always. And it would have saved them all this litigation because they would have what Congress apparently intended, a bright line rule about what they can and can't do. And then, you know, in your parlance, the debt collectors who cheat wouldn't be able to be pushing that line and move out a debt collector who's doing it fairly, because everybody would have to play by the same rule.
Well, Judge, if I could, I don't think that my client is a debt collector who cheats. I don't believe.
No. I was saying you, for your debt collector, to protect your debt collector from a debt collector that's a cheater, your client would say, I know what the rule is and I'm going to do it. And if that guy wants to cheat, he's going to lose a case. But I'm not going to, because I know what to do. Doesn't that protect the good guys who are trying to collect fairly?
I think it would, but I think it would prescribe a language that does no harm to anyone. And attaching liability and exposing debt collectors to damages, including attorney's fees and the fee shifting provisions of the FDCPA, is something that, you know, we should not be doing lightly. We should not be finding debt collectors liable.
Well, that's your argument for why your language is benign, right? That's the argument. That's your argument for why the language that's on this envelope is benign. I think we're in a preliminary step as to what this act requires. I mean, we can discuss the benign nature, but that language says to me pretty clearly, if somebody picked it up, the person who is receiving this letter has a debt. They may not have enough money to pay it because they're given the option to call and discuss making payments or discuss a way to fulfill their obligation. So, you know, I find that language problematic, but I think our real key is to back up and try to figure out what statute says and how a bright line rule might be implemented that protects your guys and protects consumers. Under the Dodd-Frank Act, that had rulemaking authority regarding debt collection, didn't they submit, the CFPB submit an amicus brief in Preston arguing that there is no benign language exception? I mean, isn't that accurate? Isn't that
well? Right? I think that there is a benign language exception, Judge.
Well,
I think
the entity charged under Dodd-Frank with speaking to this issue has entered an appearance in court and said, no, there's no such thing as a benign language exception. What is your argument as to why that's not authoritative on the act itself?
Well, Judge, First Credit's understanding is that the Federal Trade Commission is the administrative agency tasked by Congress to enforce the FDCPA at its passage. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is certainly advocating for consumers. And not necessarily in a neutral manner with respect to how these particular statutory provisions are applied. I do believe that Section 6092E can be instructive. The fact that we've read materiality into Section 6092E, the benign language exception can be viewed as an extension of that. And there is room for it, even if your honors agree that the statute on its face is not or does not lead to an absurd result. First Credit believes that it does. But if your honors disagree, I think there is still a room for the benign language exception for the reasons that I described with respect to looking analogously at Section 6092E. Lastly, your honors, I would just note that the language here, the extension of credit, I get bills all the time, you know, for my credit card company says payment in full is enclosed. We have submitted, there's not much litigation, I think, with respect to this particular language. Insurance renewals, we found a case from California from the 70s, which talked about check boxes and payment in full is enclosed in context of an insurance renewal. Just because somebody owes money to somebody doesn't make it a debt within the meaning of the FDCPA. And lastly, your honors, I would just note that we have serious questions and it's an issue of this court can take it up at this stage with respect to the plaintiff's standing. There is nothing in the first amended complaint that even suggests that the plaintiff was harmed, suffered any damage, or that she even received or read this particular letter. All of that is just assumed. We have hypothetical allegations about the least sophisticated consumer. And this honorable court would also be able to uphold the district court's decision and affirm the grant of judgment on the pleadings because the plaintiff has not suffered a cognizable harm or any concrete injury as that's been understood since the Spokio decision was first came down.
Thank you.
Thank you, your honors.
Mr. Parker, you have your rebuttal.
Thank you, your honors. My friend argues that the fact that somebody owes something doesn't necessarily mean it's a debt within the meaning of the FDCPA, but there's no particular reason to believe that even if we assume that the legislative history that we have, once again, it's part of one sentence, indicates that even if we assume that that determines the entire purpose of the statute, it says that all that is necessary is that it reveals that the envelope pertains to debt collection. It doesn't say by a debt collector, which is the entire argument the First Credit advanced in its appellee's brief. It doesn't matter whether it could have come from an original creditor or an insurance company or any of those, as long as it shows that the person owed money. Once again, that's also what this court said in Cagayan. My friend also makes a good point when he says there's a possibility here of prescribing language that does no one any harm. And that gets at why district courts love the benign language exception. It serves as a fuzzy substitute for a rigorous analysis of standing. The only purpose that it serves beyond what an analysis of standing does is that it allows courts to reject some instances in which an individual suffered a harm to a cognizable interest that Congress recognized under the FDCPA. It doesn't actually, otherwise standing would prevent all of the negative effects the benign language exception is intended to prevent.
Your opponent just argued that there's a question regarding the plaintiff's standing here, Donovan's standing, that it doesn't, the complaint is inadequate in that regard. How do you respond?
Your Honor, standing is fairly clear in this instance. It's not necessary the plaintiff suffered an actual harm. It isn't necessary that the plaintiff suffered an actual harm. It is not necessary the plaintiff was harmed in the sense of someone actually saw the letter. All that is necessary is that there was a significant risk that someone saw the letter and she would suffer any of the harms that Congress intended to protect against under the FDCPA. In this instance, that letter shows to anyone who sees it that she owes a debt and the collector doesn't think she'll be able to pay. Any number of people could have seen that letter in transit. It could have been accidentally mailed to the wrong location. After all, the checks at First Credit don't appear to be particularly good if they allowed some language like this to slip through. It's possible it could have been mailed to the wrong recipient. They could have seen it. First Credit created a substantial risk that my client would suffer shame and embarrassment as someone realized her financial predicament. That's sufficient for standing under Spokio. Additionally, my friend points out that they didn't print this information on the outside of the envelope. It's inside. That's the purpose of the bona fide error defense. It's difficult to imagine how this error in particular could be a bona fide error, but if it was a bona fide error, they are protected. Moving on, my friend cites the case Masuda and points out that case did not even cite the legislative history. That case is something of a train wreck. There's a smorgasbord of violations all throughout that case. The court finds half of them, denies half of them. It's wrong on at least two of them. And there's very little analysis on this, and it has spawned this monstrous doctrine, the benign language exception, that has taken over all of the district courts. My friend also points out that one purpose of the FDCPA is to protect ethical debt collectors. Right now, it is the most ethical debt collectors who are being penalized because they can't put things on their envelopes like time sensitive that might cause the debtor to open the envelope more often. things like, personal and confidential might cause the debtor to open the envelope more often. So the letters sent by the most compliant debt collectors are less effective right now than those sent by people who are willing to push the envelope. And that's a problem because it creates an incentive to push the envelope and nibble away at the protections that Congress intended to create by enacting a bright line rule. Also, it's worth noting that the original statute indicates that an original creditor, can in fact do debt collection. It states in 1692A6 that an original creditor is not a debt collector when collecting in its own name, but is when collecting in another name. So that indicates an original creditor can do debt collection, which means that if legislative history determines the purpose of 1692F8, then even if the letter could have come from an original creditor, which First Credit argues, even if it could have come from an original creditor, it still would be a letter that pertains to debt collection, still be revealed on the outside of the envelope. There's simply no way to argue that this language doesn't reveal it pertains to collecting some sort of debt. If the only two options shown are payment enclosed is in full is enclosed and my phone number is. So for those reasons, we respectfully request that the district court be reversed and remanded. Unless you have any further questions, I cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument. The case will be submitted and you may disconnect from the argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.